Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales. In this interview, we talk about the topic of suicide. Should you or someone you know need support, please call the Mental Health Access Line on 1-800-011-511 or find a support service online at ruok.org.au/find help. Welcome to Coffee with a Coastie. I had the pleasure of sitting down with Alex Wilson from Mindful Recovery Services. After being helped by counsellors to navigate her own difficult teenage years, Alex has gone on to forge a successful career in mental health, helping teenagers and young adults. Alex's journey is one of inspiration, so I was excited to get the opportunity to sit down and chat with Alex.
Thank you, Alex, for inviting me into your practice to sit down and say hello and chat. And I just wondered, obviously, this is like my whole, the basis of this podcast is people on the Central Coast.
Yeah.
So I just wondered, how did you come to live on the Central Coast?
So my husband's originally from the Central Coast. So we met in Sydney. We were both working at Royal North Shore Hospital at that time. He's a nurse and I'm a social worker. And so we were both working there. And yeah, we got together and then he sort of introduced me to Avoca. He actually grew up just down the street from here, literally about 10 houses that way. And his parents still live there.
On the same street?
Yeah, same street.
Oh, wow.
So when we were planning to have kids, we wanted to move out of Sydney just financial reasons and also just, you know, the environment up here just seemed good for raising kids. So yeah, we moved up here when our eldest was 4 weeks old. And yeah, we've been here ever since. So for him, it's like moving back to his childhood home, but it's new for me. So yeah.
Did you have family up here?
No, not at all. So my family sort of scattered all around, but my mum's in Byron Bay, my dad's in Sydney, my brother's in America. So kind of all over the place.
And that sounds exactly the same reason we ended up on the Central Coast, actually. We were in Sydney and I had previously had grandparents that lived at Baddow.
Yeah.
And we had young kids and I just knew.
Yeah.
Just felt like the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And
yeah, definitely. So yeah, you know, financially it made sense and lifestyle wise it just made sense.
Mm.
And Greg, my husband, being a nurse, he could, you know, get a job up here easy with the hospital. So he did that. And yeah, I decided to take that opportunity to move into private practice, which I'd already sort of been thinking about, but it was kind of impetus to do that. Yeah.
That's interesting. So you said you obviously met your husband when you first started in 2004, did you, at Royal North Shore?
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, I met him in 2002. I was a social work student at Royal North Shore. We were both working on the respiratory ward. He was a nurse, I was a student, and we sort of had mutual friends. And then, yeah, we got together a little bit after that, and then we got married in 2005. And then we both worked at Royal North Shore, me in mental health and him in ICU, until we moved up here in 2010. We were both there.
What did you do before? Did you do anything before or did you go straight from school?
I went straight from school into a social work degree at Sydney Uni. And then I originally went into hospital social work, so like critical care settings, like emergency departments and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And then I kind of fell into mental health. Well, I had exposure to mental health working in emergency departments, but it actually wasn't my plan to specialize in mental health. Really, but I kind of fell into it. There was a job came up that sounded interesting, so I took it in community mental health and just found that I loved it. But I had also, it happened in kind of a roundabout way, because when I was a teenager, I had a real difficult teenage life. I was a very difficult teenager, objectively, gave my parents hell. I did not want to do what I was told. And so I had quite a rough teenage years. They actually sent me to a boarding school in America for 2.5 years. So it got me out of the country.
And that's because you were so difficult.
Yes. Yes. Because I was so difficult and getting kicked out of school and just not complying to anything.
Yeah.
So I got sent to this school and I was lucky enough to meet some, you know, counselors that worked there that I really bonded with, and they really helped me navigate that time. So that's why I went into social work, because I thought I want to work with young people, but I didn't really know what that would look like.
Mm.
And then I just kind of, you know, in the healthcare system, ended up in a mental health role and felt like that was a good fit. And that was the way I could help, you know, teenagers and young adults in particular, doing that role.
At what stage? So obviously you're in the US and you said the counselor in the US helped you greatly.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what stage did you go from, I'm going to call it troubled, I don't know what else.
Troubled
teen. Being a troubled teen, troubled child, to going, I want to flip that and help troubled teens.
So it took a while. I was in the US for 2.5 years, and it was probably a year and a half in before I decided, you know, I might actually want to turn this around. For the first year or so over there, I was like, screw this. I just want to go home and do what I want to do. But I think after about a year and a bit, I started to realize that I could do more. You know, I thought, okay, I think I've got a decent brain and I could probably do something helpful. And I think I just started feeling better about myself. I think that's what those relationships over there helped me with, is just like, you know, figuring out my own identity and my own values and who I was and what I wanted to do. I think up until that point, I was a bit lost with that. I really didn't know what I could give to the world. So it was just a really long process of discovering that. Yeah.
Does anything specific, like, you know, you just said there was a process, like finding your values, whatever. Is there anything specific you remember back then that someone did or said or something?
There were some experiences around, we did some like outdoor experiences. So like we went cross-country skiing in the Rocky Mountains, like in the real backwoods Rocky Mountains for 2 weeks. And that was a really pivotal experience for me. I think that showed me that I could do really hard things, and it made me feel a sense of pride, which I think I hadn't really felt before. And then just having the unconditional support of those counselors there. There were a few of them that were really influential, but no matter how difficult I was, they just always supported me and saw the best in me. Mm. And that was really helpful, because I hadn't really had that before either. So I think it was a combination of just doing hard things and realizing I could do them and discovering that about myself. And then just having people that saw me in a really great light, and I was able to kind of start to see myself in that way.
And was the school specifically for that? Like, was it like it was for troubled teens, basically?
It was one of those like brat camp places.
Yeah.
One of those, if you've seen those shows.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. It was called Rocky Mountain Academy. It was just for troubled teens.
That's the Rocky Mountain Academy. I Googled that, and it was all in the US. Yeah. Yeah. It was all, I'm like, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I remember thinking Rocky Mountain Academy, because it's on your LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Rocky Mountain Academy, Googled it, and it's all in like Vancouver. And I'm like, Rocky, how can it be? Like, there's no other mention of any.
It's closed down now. I think in the 2000s at some stage.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was part of CEDU schools, which they have a bunch of places in the States, which are all for, it's the troubled teen industry.
Gee, your parents must have real. That's amazing. Yeah. And I do remember seeing the Rocky Mountain Academy and thinking, and Googling it, and everything was in the US. I'm like,
this
doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, it was really hard. It was, a real eye opener. But it ended up being the best thing for me.
Mm.
Yeah. Just to get me out of, just get me in a different environment with different influences, and just to be able to do different things. Because school, even though I was good at school, I did not like school. I hated it. So staying in school was a problem for me. So over there we did schooling, but we also did like a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of, you know, other things aside from just school.
Now it's sort of a lot more acceptable, and especially seems since COVID potentially, and that is people traveling, like taking a year off and taking their kids in a caravan around Australia or whatever that is.
Yeah.
It's become a lot more acceptable, and obviously it was already known back then
that
interaction's potentially a lot better for some kids.
Yeah, because it's a very small amount of kids that really fit the way that we teach in schools. You know, it's such a narrow focus of like sit down, be quiet, listen, and then give us that information back. Mm-hmm. There's so few kids that learn that way. Yet, you know, that's the system we have now. That's fine. But for a lot of kids, they learn experientially, they learn physically, they learn creatively. There's loads of different ways that kids can learn. And so for me, academics wasn't the challenge. It was more that like personal learning that I really needed that I wasn't getting here.
Interesting. And so then you've gone on to specialize, I understand, in, I hope I say this correctly, dialectical behavioral therapy.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Which I understand was only recently, well, you know, to me, recently developed in the late 1980s by Dr. Marcia Lyneham.
Yes.
But when I read about it, it was to treat individuals, at the time when it was developed, it was specifically to treat individuals with borderline personality disorder and chronic suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Can you share what about it was specifically for that and then how it's gone on? Because then I also read about it, how it's gone on now to be adapted and changed slightly or however, whatever it is, to be able to treat a broader range of mental health issues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So up until the development of DBT, there really was no treatment for borderline personality disorder. It was considered one of those conditions like, oh, well, too bad, doesn't respond to medication, doesn't respond to regular therapy. And so when DBT came along, it was like, oh, okay, finally we have something to treat this. Now, borderline personality disorder, it's a bit of a funny diagnosis because it's a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that people get that diagnosis usually when doctors are like, okay, so it's not anxiety, it's not depression, it's not bipolar, it's not this, it's not that, it must be borderline personality disorder. So it's kind of funny like that. But one of the most difficult things about borderline personality disorder is that it often involves chronic suicidal ideation. And borderline personality disorder is still one of the most deadly mental illnesses. So it has the highest fatality rate. Anorexia nervosa is number one and borderline personality disorder is number two.
Anorexia is number one.
Yes. So, you know, we're talking about very high rates of suicide and yet we didn't have a good treatment for it until, you know, the 90s. So the different thing about DBT is that firstly, it's aimed at people with risky behaviors, whereas other psychological therapies are not. So one of the problems that we still have in our community is that we have this gap between regular, in inverted commas, you know, psychology services, right, which are for mild to moderate kind of acuity issues. So people that are still able to function in their day-to-day and, you know, aren't super risky but need some help. And then you've got nothing up until the hospital services, which are acute mental health services for people that need hospital admission.
Mm.
There's this big gap in between, and that's where DBT sort of fits because it was designed to work with risk. And yes, the original research showed it to be sort of the gold standard for treatment of borderline personality disorder and suicidality. But now we have lots of studies showing it's effective for drug and alcohol issues, eating disorder issues. What else? Anything where emotion regulation is problematic.
Mm.
Sometimes, you know, angry, like outbursts, those sorts of behaviors, some types of anxiety disorders, things like that. So wherever there's where people are struggling to regulate emotions, DBT can help with that.
And how did it has it changed over the years to be more broadly applied?
Yeah, so I think just more research has been done. So originally when it was developed, the research was aimed just at that borderline personality disorder group and some, you know, really great, you know, studies showing that was effective. And now there's been an opportunity to study it in lots of different settings. So we've also got research now to show that DBT can even be applied in a brief form. So the original model of DBT was 12 months and it was really intensive. And we do programs like that in our practice, but we also now have programs that have been studied that are much shorter, you know, 10, 12 week programs that still have effectiveness. So shortened versions, so they call it brief DBT, inpatient settings, outpatient settings. So we've just got more research now to show.
Yeah.
And funnily, in America, it's widely practiced. It's one of the most widely practiced therapies. But for some reason, it's been much slower to catch on here in Australia. So they use it everywhere. If you go to a psychology clinic in America, everyone there practices DBT.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's been a little slower. And I don't know why that is, but we're trying to change that.
So. Mm-hmm. Around 13 years ago now, you started Mindful Recovery Services as a private practice focused on providing mental health treatment and support for teens and adults struggling with complex mental health issues. And you've mentioned to me, you'll soon be opening Central Coast DBT Centre at Erina in March 2024. I assume that's still on schedule.
Yep.
What was it, though, that inspired you 13 years ago to go out on your own?
Yeah. So a couple of things. So when I was working in the public mental health system, so I was working in community mental health teams and inpatient psychiatric wards. And in that role, I was involved in starting a DBT program in the public service. So I got to see, that was my first exposure to DBT therapy, and I got to see how effective it was for all these clients that hadn't responded to things before. So I was involved with that program for a few years, and then when I decided to go out on my own, it made sense for me for that to be my focus because I'd seen how effective it was.
Mm.
And I really loved working with that client group who previously had really poor outcomes in the mental health services. We just couldn't offer them very much until we had a DBT program.
Yeah.
So I was really passionate about that. And I wanted to move into private practice really because, to be honest, I got sick of all the red tape in the public service.
Yeah.
I felt like there was so much that got in the way of actually doing the work with people. So many meetings, so many policies, so many rules. It's so much that would take up our days that, you know, we barely got to see clients in between all of that. So I really wanted to move into private practice where the bulk of the work is just seeing people and not having all of that other bureaucratic stuff to deal with. So yeah, I wanted to just do the work, and DBT I was already passionate about, and I could see that not many people were doing it, and I thought this is really needed and these are the types of people that I want to work with. And yeah, so it made sense for that to be my focus.
And do you do other services there?
Like other types of therapies?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So DBT is the main one, but we also do, you know, trauma therapy, traditional cognitive behavioral therapies.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of other things that, you know, depending on the presentation, we'll adapt.
Yeah.
But almost everything we do has some flavor of DBT in it. We have a range of different programs. So, you know, some people might come in just for one-on-one sessions, and we might teach some DBT and some CBT and some other things, depending on their needs. But other people might come in, say, for our 12-month program, and we'll be doing 90% of that will be DBT focused groups and one-on-ones and a whole bunch of stuff like that.
Yeah
the
group stuff, so is that a group of patients?
Yep.
How do people feel about anonymous, like, you know, like, and being amongst
privacy
and
stuff? Yeah So some people have concerns before they join a group. The main concerns, there are sometimes concerns about privacy, and the way we get around that, I mean, everybody in the group signs an agreement around confidentiality. So you don't share names outside the group. You don't do any of that. And everybody's there for the same reason.
Yeah.
So we've never had an issue with that. People are very respectful of that. The other thing people worry about with a group is a lot of people feel anxious in groups. And they feel pressure to, like, talk and share and things like that. Our groups, they're not like a sit around and everyone talk about your feelings type group. They're a learning group.
Yeah.
So we're there to learn skills and techniques and concepts. And we are, you know, very flexible in how people do that. So we might get some young people who come in who find it really hard to just sit and listen. So they'll be, you know, we'll have fidget toys. We have things they can do. They might lie down on the floor. They might have their phone out. That's all fine with us. However you learn, you can come and just learn.
Yeah.
And then we repeat ourselves a lot. So, you know, we assume that people are only going to take in some of the content. So we just repeat and repeat. We have lots of different ways for people to learn the same stuff. And typically, you know, people start to feel comfortable and warm up. Our groups are small, so they're capped at 10. So yeah, that people tend to kind of warm up and feel comfortable within a few weeks, but there's really no pressure. It's kind of just show up, and if you're here, great. There's no pressure to share or to do anything like that. You only share what you want to share. There's no forced participation. We don't do icebreakers or any of that silly stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to share, great. If you don't, great.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to us. So we're all just there to learn.
Yeah. I highly recommend, I think group stuff is great. If you're in a group with a bunch of people who are experiencing the same thing,
yeah,
you'll learn so much more than if you're one-on-one and you haven't.
Yeah.
I feel like it's something to do with the moment you recognize somebody else is going through what I'm going through and I'm not alone. I think that just in itself just lets you raise above and not feel isolated and alone and
absolutely
all the rest of it goes with that.
That's the real power of groups, is that you hear somebody share something and you identify with it and you go, oh, okay, it's not just me.
Mm.
And it's also a way, because the mental health system can also be really pathologizing and stigmatizing. You know, we get people commonly in our groups who have maybe, you know, been in mental health services for 10 or more years, had lots of diagnoses thrown their way, and, you know, have this image of themselves as very mentally ill. And then they come into a group and they realize, oh, like this is actually, there are other people that feel this way too. Mm. It's not, you know, I'm not this like really messed up person that, you know, it's like, no, other people struggle too. Mm. It's just people mask it. And, you know, people you run into day to day, you'd never know. But then you sit down in a group for a couple of hours and suddenly all this stuff, you know, starts to come out.
Mm.
And you realize we're actually all dealing with very similar things.
Mm.
So, yeah, the group's super powerful.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the last person I got to sit down and chat with. Luke Grant runs men's groups over 30, and like the impact that has on men's mental health and that sort of stuff. Any of that group,
it's huge.
Environment is massive. But the initial act, I feel, of someone putting themselves in that situation,
that's
is like
the challenge.
Heart fluttering, nerve wracking.
If you can push through that fear and anxiety of initially going, and then you start to feel comfortable from there. But yeah, that's the biggest hurdle, is actually just getting there, that first or
second
session.
I want to do this and I feel this way.
Yeah.
Take the action.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So in looking at it and researching you, I found you do martial arts.
I do.
And I think in one of the things it was like, I'm preparing for a black belt, and I can't remember the terminology because I'm not a martial arts person.
Yeah.
As much as
it's
one of those things that whenever I see it, someone does martial arts and has been doing it for years, I'm like, man, I wish that was me, you know. And you're trying to the kids, oh, okay, right, where am I going to fit it in at the moment? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
But I also think, and I find it interesting when someone like yourself does something like that, because everyone always talks about the discipline of martial arts and not necessarily the physical side of it, but the mental side of martial arts.
Yeah.
And so I wondered how martial arts over the years, and I'm curious how long you've been doing it for too, like has helped with your own mental health and the impact that's had.
Yeah. So martial arts and physical exercise actually plays a huge part in my life. I could not live without it. So I've been doing martial arts since, oh gosh, what year was it? Okay. So it's been, I think it's been about 8 years now. So I've got a first degree black belt in kickboxing. I'm hoping next year to test for my second degree. So
kickboxing.
Yeah.
As well.
Oh. Yeah. So we've got, so you get your black belt, and then there are levels of black belt. So you get first degree, second degree, da 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 da. And I teach kickboxing at the dojo twice a week as well, which I really love. So I've done that since I got my black belt. That's just at Black Belt Martial Arts at King Kumba, who are awesome. I love that. And then I also am doing Japanese weapons. So we call it Kobudo, which is like traditional Japanese weapons. Like
samurai swords and stuff.
Yeah, like big long bow stuff and sai, nunchucks, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I just got my red belt in that. So I'm about a year and a bit away from a black belt in that. Fingers crossed, all things going to plan. And I love that too. It's very different to kickboxing, but it's at the same place.
Yeah.
But just different types of martial arts. So I think there's a few things. Physical exercise for me is super important at maintaining like mental health.
And do you do physical exercise like gym, yoga, like that sort of stuff?
I do CrossFit as well, which is
CrossFit. Okay, you do
how
CrossFit.
I know Ash.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So,
he's
I
massive
do,
CrossFit. He's like,
yeah.
he couldn't promote CrossFit enough.
I know. He's all about it. Yeah. So yeah, I did CrossFit as well and also martial arts. So it's a pretty busy schedule, but I really love it. And so there's the benefits of like the physical exercise, makes me sleep better, makes me feel better, all that sort of stuff. But the social aspect is huge for me. So like, you know, my CrossFit gym, my dojo, these are like home away from home for me. You know, I see these people so many times during the week. They become like, you know, a second family, and they're just really important spaces for me. If I'm having a hard day, that's the best thing I can do is like just go and train. So there's that social aspect. Also, you know, because I didn't grow up on the coast, it's helped me make friends and meet people. And then the other thing that's been really important is, again, that concept of doing something hard and developing a skill and pushing like outside of your comfort zone, which I think is really helpful for mental health, because we can get trapped in this kind of pattern where we start to avoid things that feel scary. And when we do that, we have to then avoid more and more and more. The world actually starts to feel more and more scary. And I understand that, you know, I mean, I've had anxiety myself, but the answer for that is actually the opposite. Rather than avoiding and hiding away, we actually need to push more, right? We need to do things that are difficult and challenging and not be too hard on ourselves, but, you know, to do hard things. And then to feel that amazing sense of pride when we reach that goal, or we can see that, oh, okay, I can do that now and I couldn't do that a year ago, or I'm able to teach something now that I didn't know a year ago. That does a lot for self-esteem, I feel. So, yeah, there's a few things in it that are really important, but, yeah, it's an essential part of my life.
And do you recommend that to people? Like if you can see somebody, I'm assuming then you say, hey, look,
yeah,
this could also be a benefit outside of therapy of any kind.
So definitely I always recommend some form of enjoyable movement. So I think sometimes people get fixated with exercise. It's around like burning calories, and we don't want it to be around that, right? So enjoyable movement is whatever you enjoy that gets your body moving. So for me, it's martial arts and CrossFit. For someone else, it might be taking their dog down to the beach every morning. For someone else, it might be joining a soccer team. Anything that you enjoy that involves movement, find it and do it on a regular basis. And if you can find people to do it with, even better, because then we've got the social aspect, the physical aspect, and the mental aspect, all together. We know from the research that exercise is amazing for mental health. In fact, a lot of studies show that regular exercise is probably just as effective as antidepressant medication for some people. So, you know, regular movement, but again, it's about finding what you love. It's not about just going and slogging it out at the gym. If you hate the gym, don't do that. So yeah, it's definitely something I recommend, but yeah, find your own thing. So if martial arts is your thing, awesome, but that's not going to be everybody's thing. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
Just movement, some kind of social aspect, and something that makes you feel a sense of mastery and accomplishment, you know?
So I've asked this a few times, actually. I feel a privilege to be able to sit down and pick someone like your brain, right? And I've asked this a few times now of different people that are in different fields of either exercise or the same sort of some sort of mental health. And that is resilience in children. So one of the things you talked about then was, you know, being able to push yourself that little bit more, and especially in a physical activity with kids. And not wanting, like, and I've spoken to people that have had traumatic childhoods, and they've no or traumatic adult, no teens, adults, be like, so and no one wants their own children to go through that. Yet they want their children to have the resilience they now have from experiencing that. And it's like, well, where do you find the happy medium, right?
Yes.
And I'm curious, two things. One is your thoughts on that, and how do you build resilience, how your thoughts on resilience for children. And the other thing is, and use my own children as an example, is like, you want to push your kids to go do something that's hard, but they can't see the point in doing something that's hard right now at 8 or 9 or 10. Like, I don't know how old your kids are. I've got 8, 6, and 5 months. And I know at 8, you see something. My daughter's like really good at swimming. And you just think, gee, if only you could push through the barrier and just, you know, you'd kill it. But, and I was talking to someone recently at a family Christmas thing, and that difference between like the Olympic champion and the kid that could have been that easily because they had the talent, they just don't have the discipline or the resilience to be able to go through what it takes to get there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not talking about building resilience to be an Olympic swimmer, but just even building some sort of resilience in children.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a really tricky topic because I think, you know, in our culture today, there's a lot of protecting of children so that they don't have bad experiences. And I understand. So, yeah, my kids are 13 and 9. You don't want your kids to be upset. You don't want them to have a hard time. However, feeling bad is a part of life. It's a really important part of life. And we can't protect our kids from that. But even if we could, we shouldn't. Now, there are some types of feeling bad that, you know, we want to minimize, you know, like excessive bullying and things like this that we know are long-term, really damaging things. But short-term distress is not a damaging thing for a child. And it's actually really important that we as parents model feeling bad is normal and a part of life, and it's not something to be afraid of. Short-term distress, you can get through it, right? You'll feel fine tomorrow. You just got to ride it out. And I think, I mean, with my kids, what we try and do is say, okay, so for example, my 9-year-old plays basketball, right? Loves basketball. But there are some days where he doesn't really feel like going to basketball. Just like there are some days I don't feel like going to the dojo, right? But we just have a deal of like, you can't quit at short notice, right? If you're going to quit, you've got to take your time. You've got to weigh up the pros and cons. You've got to really think about it and make a wise decision. You can't just quit on the day. Right. And you certainly can't quit if you've had a bad match or a bad day or something like that. Right. You can't quit when it gets hard. So I guess, you know, the thing is to, I think kids should be able to make their own decisions in regards to, okay, if I love this or if I don't, if he's not loving basketball anymore and he's consistently not loving it, then I'm not going to push him to play basketball, even though he might be great at it. If he doesn't love it, what's the point? Right. But I'm not going to encourage just something gets hard and then you drop it, right? Because it will get hard. And anything worth doing is going to be hard sometimes. So I think it's like we're trying to find a middle ground, you know? We don't want to be ruled by our emotions and just avoid what's difficult. But we also don't want to push at something if it's not for us. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, yes, I think it's a middle ground, and I think it's tricky. As parents, we're trying to find this balance between pushing our kids and exposing them to difficult things and also protecting them. We don't want to go too far either way, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's why I was curious of your opinion, because I do. Yeah. It's something as a parent that plays in the back of my head that you don't like, you know, you just, there's things you don't want your children to experience, but yet you don't want them to fall over at the drop of a hat because something got that little bit too hard either. You know, because you know that there's no escaping something that's difficult.
They have to experience unpleasant emotions in order to build resilience. And so, you know, in my work, when a young person, say a teenager, comes in here to see me, one of the first things we talk about is the goal is not to get rid of distress. Right? Distress is a normal part of life. The goal is to increase your tolerance to distress. And we talk about it in regards to sometimes we say like moving the goalposts, because usually people come to see me because they want to get rid of distress. And I understand that goal. If I had a magic wand, maybe, but we can't do that. And then we talk about actually that's not a great goal, because you're going to have to avoid everything in life trying to attain that. And then that's going to make life worse. Instead, we're going to try and build tolerance to distress, which means we're going to intentionally do things that are difficult, but we're going to do them in like a measured way so that we're not overwhelmed, and we're going to learn other skills to manage those feelings that don't involve avoiding those feelings, right? So how do I sit with this feeling? How do I get through a bad day? How do I get through a bad game or a bad match without the world falling apart? Because those feelings, they pass, right? We have this belief in our society that like feeling bad is this big dangerous thing that can destroy us. It's not. It's just emotions. Even the most intense emotion of pain or fear or whatever is temporary, and can't actually cause us physical harm. The things that can cause us harm are our attempts to get away from distress. So if a client comes to see me and they're self-harming, for example, it's not the emotions that are causing the problem. It's the self-harm, which is their attempt to get away from the emotions. Does that make sense?
Mm, absolutely.
So avoidance is the problem, not the emotions. And that's one of the key things that we try and do in DBT therapy is to explain we want to befriend our emotions, even the yucky ones,
yeah.
and see avoidance as the problem. That avoidance is always going to make things way worse than the emotions ever will.
Mm. You mentioned somewhere in there about an exercise to, you give them an exercise to go and not avoid that distress. Yep. Have you got an example of?
So let's take, for example, say somebody came in and anxiety was a problem. So that's one of the most common symptoms that we see. Say they were having anxiety about busy public places, right? So Erin Affair is one that people often mention, right? I hate Erin Affair. It's so busy, right? Often what's happened is that there's a pattern, if we have a look at it, their anxiety started and then they started avoiding more and more and more busy places, and then they get to the point they're like, now I can't go anywhere. My anxiety is so bad. So we might start with, okay, I want you to walk to your mailbox a couple of times a day, right? Start off small. Go out, walk to the mailbox, walk back, because some people struggle even just to leave the house, right? Then we might expand it. I want you to walk down to the end of your street and come back, right? Then I want you to go to that corner shop, right, down the road, and that'll be the goal. And then we'll just build it up gradually from there. However, while they're doing that, I want them to be using new skills that we're learning. So I want them to learn how to change their body chemistry if needed. So, you know, we go into that fight flight mode where our heart starts to race and we start to feel like physically really, if you've ever had a panic attack, you know what it feels like. It's super intense.
Oh, shit. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Awful feeling. So the whole body is just freaking out. There are some physical skills that we teach people to help switch that off, which is really important because if you're having panic attacks all the time, it's really hard to function. So there's some skills to change body chemistry that they need to learn. Then we also work on things like skillful distraction and how to use that just at times when it's needed. We work on self-soothing skills. We work on, you know, challenging fears about, again, what emotions can do to us. So we work on all these skills and then get them to gradually do more and more difficult things whilst using the skills. And then, okay, that went all right. I did that. Then they feel confident and do the next one, do the next one and do the next one. So, and it's always at the person's pace, but I'm going to push a little bit to say, let's do things that maybe get you at, you know, a 6 out of 10, not a 10 out of 10, but a 6 out of 10. And let's work on that until that number comes down, and then we'll work to the next thing.
Yeah.
So, because avoidance is just going to make it worse, but we do need to have other skills and strategies before I can ask somebody to face the scary things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm completely aware of the body. Like in my, I'm going to say 20s, 20, 21. Because I know at my 21st, I was a mess.
Yeah.
In my 20s, I started suffering from full anxiety. I actually rushed myself to hospital a few times.
It's really
through not being able to breathe.
Yep. Yeah. People think they're going to die.
Felt like I was suffocating. Unfortunately, back then, I go to hospital and they just say, it's all in your mind. You're just having an anxiety attack. Go home.
Relax.
Relax. and that was literally our treatment.
Yeah.
And I just, and I've spoken to somebody about this, I just started to recognize after about the, you know, after getting the ambulance to come to the train station and blowing in a paper bag and all that sort of stuff going on over a period of about a year, that it's starting in my body. Like my body had all of a sudden start feeling and somehow I managed to recognize that, and over some lengthy period of time could control it and slow it down in my body first before it got to my mind and completely overtook me. And I had, because it's like you just got no control once it gets to the mind, once it moved from the body to the mind. I just found
it was out of control. The reoccurring loop between my body and my mind was just too much, and you couldn't control it. But the moment I ever got to a hospital, I'd be fine. Because it's like, I'm in a safe place now. And they'd be like, look, you're all right. And I'm like, oh, I know I am all right. And the moment the ambulance would turn up at the train station, I'd be like, but you're all right. I'm like, yeah, I know I'm all right now. This paper bag seems like a worthless piece of thing, you know. But, gee, once the mind and the body are connected in a spiral, out of control thing, it's very, very, I found it impossible. I found it, in the end, I found it, I could, once if I could control it in the body before it got up and made its way above my shoulders, I was good. But
exactly. So what you learnt to do is recognize those symptoms and kind of label them like, oh, I know what this is. Okay. So this is anxiety. This is panic. This is, you know, what my body does, as opposed to, oh, there's an actual threat, you know, because yes, panic attacks are that they're like the fear of the fear almost, right? So once it goes from body to mind, it's like, okay, my body's freaking out. My mind is freaking out. There's clearly like something very scary going on. And it can feel like you're going to die.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, terrifying. That feeling of impending doom is very real.
And because you don't feel like you've, once it's in that spiral, you just don't feel like you've got any control over your own
body.
It's out of control.
What we know happens in the brain when we hit that fight flight mode, right? So like a panic attack, what happens is that the frontal lobe of the brain, which is all our rational, analytical, advanced brain stuff, actually switches off. And that's for a good reason, because if my, so the amygdala is in the midbrain and that's the threat detector. So that's designed to tell us if there's a threat, and then it starts that fight flight response, right? Makes us stronger and faster. So if you imagine, from an evolutionary point of view. So my amygdala gets triggered because my brain thinks, oh, there's a lion running at you, right? If I pause to like weigh up the data and like think about whether I should run, I'm dead. So our brain purposely, that primitive fight flight will override the advanced brain every day of the week. That's not a broken brain. That's a healthy brain. The problem is it thinks there's lions everywhere and there's no lions. But we know that some people have way more active fight-flight responses than others. It can be genetic, right? It can run in families. There's a very strong correlation there. So if my parent, you know, struggled with anxiety or depression, it's much more likely that I'm going to have anxiety show up for me. We know that trauma produces a very active threat detector, you know, very active fight-flight for good reason. And a lot of people that are diagnosed with borderline personality disorder have trauma, childhood trauma. And so they have very active threat detectors for very good reason, because their brains learnt the world's dangerous. Drugs and alcohol can have an impact. And sometimes we don't know. It's actually an evolutionary advantage to be highly anxious, right? Because you're more likely to stay alive. So it's not...
That's how I made it.
That's how I think about it too. So it's a very clever brain. The problem is that's the primitive part of the brain that cannot tell the difference between a lion and like, oh, that person just looked at me weird, right? It treats it the same way. Or sometimes there's not even an obvious trigger. Sometimes the first sign of anxiety can be a physical symptom. And again, that can just be something that's happening in our nervous system that we can't control. And it can be debilitating. So, learning how to change your body chemistry in those moments so that it doesn't turn into the full-blown.
And that's what reminded me of it too, when you're talking about teaching them ways to control their body's state.
We've got to work with body chemistry, because you could have all the fancy psychological knowledge in the world, but when you're in fight-flight mode, you can't access it because that's in the frontal lobe, right?
Yeah, and it's shut down.
It's shut down. So that's why you can't think your way out of a panic attack, or you can't talk someone down out of a panic attack because they can't hear you, right? That part of their brain switched off, which is often frustrating for loved ones. They're like, just calm down. And you're like...
And you're like, just don't talk to me.
Yeah, get away. It's all noise.
Interesting,
So, you know, these different things, we've got to learn those circuit breakers, right? How do I get in real quick? And it often takes a lot of practice, right? Of like, okay, this is what I do when I feel that sensation, or this is what I do when I notice I'm like getting activated. And I just do that real quickly so that I don't spiral. And then I can think about what I'm going to do next.
Mm.
But we need a circuit breaker in there somewhere.
Can I ask, it's a very generic question, yeah. I've no doubt, but would you have a circuit breaker, like a generic yeah. sort of circuit breaker that yeah. you can talk about? That...
So there's four real good ones yeah. that we teach. The best one, which is going to sound really kooky, okay, but bear with me. The best one is to stick your head in a sink full of cold water.
All right.
So that triggers something called the dive reflex, right? So all mammals are born with this dive reflex where if we dive into very cold water, it's like hitting a big deactivate button in the nervous system, drops our heart rate instantly to below our resting heart rate, switches everything down. And that's designed to help us get to the other side, right, without losing a lot of heat and energy. It's just a nifty little thing. We're all born with it. So if I can trick my body into thinking I'm diving into cold water, it'll do that. It'll switch off that fight flight instantly. So yeah, cold sink of water, head in, hold your breath as long as is comfortable. That'll do it. Or a cold compress on your face, hold your breath, bend over, that'll do it.
It's the bending over action as well, because that makes your body yeah. feel like it's diving. Yeah.
Four main elements to get the full effect. It's got to be wet, cold, you got to be bending over and holding your breath. Those four things will trigger the dive reflex instantly, 100% of the time.
Yeah, wow.
That's the fastest way we know to get out of fight flight mode. Now, the problem is you don't always have access to a good sink. But it's a great one to use at home. We also know 20 minutes of intense exercise will do it. That's not always practical, but that will work. So a 7 out of 10 exertion-wise for 20 minutes will switch that off. So some of my clients, they might like leave their runners by the door, and as soon as they notice they're getting triggered, they just chuck them on and off they go. 20 minutes, fast walking, running, whatever, and then everything waits till they come back and then they can think straight. There's a paced breathing exercise, which it's an inhale for 4 seconds and an exhale for 8. So this is not
like box breathing.
Sort of like box breathing. It's not deep breathing. What we're trying to do is make sure our exhale is at least twice as long as the inhale. Because on the exhale, our heart rate goes down and we're also not over oxygenating, which is what we do when we kind of go into freak out mode.
Yeah.
So long exhales. We teach this to little kids by doing bubble breathing. We get them to breathe, like blow bubbles, because it's the same idea. You can do this with your kids at home, like mm. teach them how to do bubble breathing. And then there's also a tense and release exercise, which is where we tense up muscles on both sides of the body for 20 seconds, release and repeat for a couple of minutes. That'll work as well. So typically when I teach those skills to clients and my team, we teach those skills to everyone that walks through our door, and we'll get them to practice them all. And most people find maybe 2 out of the 4 that work best for them, and they just become their go-tos.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So very physical stuff. Then after we do that, we can throw all the other psychology in there, but we've got to deal with the body chemistry first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I know from my own experience, it always started in the body.
Yeah. And that's what gets people frustrated. They're like, I'm trying so hard to deal with this problem and to reduce, you know, my anxiety or my panic attacks or my triggers. But when you get triggered at a certain point, you can try all you want. It's not going to work. You have to know the skills.
Mm.
So that's a relief for a lot of people, because they're like, oh, it's not just because I wasn't trying hard enough. And we talk to parents and families and schools about that too.
Yeah.
It's not that this person is not trying. It's just you got the wrong set of skills. We need some other skills first, and then we'll get into all that other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, more of that. I guess what they teach in traditional cognitive behavioral therapy is like challenging thoughts and all that sort of stuff. That's great, but we can't do that unless we've changed body chemistry first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to explore the topic of values, because I read you'd written something on a post or something somewhere that I'd read saying that, and probably because I am challenged with this myself, so I'm very interested in it,
yeah,
that values can be a tricky topic to explore when working with someone, especially if the person struggles to identify with anything that they enjoy or are passionate about. And also if they happen to have emotional regulation and self-identity issues.
Mm.
So I wondered, can you share how someone could start to explore and identify their values
if they do struggle to identify with what their values are, as they struggle to identify what they enjoy and are passionate about.
Yeah. So this is a really tricky area for a lot of people. You know, we often give this advice to people of like, just be yourself, right? And for most people, they're like, what the hell are you talking? I don't know what that is. What does that even mean?
We're so influenced growing up by everything around us that you lose who you potentially are, you know?
And I think too that, you know, we don't have like this static, permanent sense of self necessarily. We actually have different kind of versions of ourself. Like if you think about, I'm not the same person at work as I am teaching a martial arts class or hanging out with my kids or, you know, going out to dinner with my partner. Like there's still a sense of me, but there's like different variations. And also as I, you know, grow over time, my sense of self changes too. What I like, you know, my preferences, what I'm passionate about, that changes as well. So, you know, I think this idea of just be yourself as if there's this like one static thing that this is me is a myth. We're complex and we're highly changeable. But I think when we're exploring values and sense of self, the best questions to be asking ourselves, first of all, is like, what am I interested in? And like, what gets me fired up? So that can be, those are broad enough questions to be like, okay, well, what am I interested in? How do I spend my time? And that's something I'll often explore with people. Well, how are you spending your time? Will I go to work? Okay, well, what do you do at work, right? And what parts of that do you like and what parts of that do you not like? What do you do when you have time off? What do you, you know, trying to find like what are those things that you're choosing to do in between all the things you need to do? And then what are the things that get you fired up? Like what are the things that create a strong emotional response in you? Are there certain topics that you're really passionate about, right? Like if someone starts talking to me about mental health, right? I'm just like going to go, right? Because I'm like really passionate about it. That's part of my identity. That's part of, you know, that's part of me. It's part of my values. So what are those things? You know, I might be talking to someone and they say, well, I get really fired up if I see like animal cruelty. Okay, so that tells me you have strong values around compassion and empathy and justice, right? We can dig down into that and start to see these are things you really value. When we see somebody, you know, get really interested and vocal about something. So those are the questions that I'll always ask. Like, what gets you fired up? And, you know, what do you do in those in-between times when you don't have to do all the things that you have to do? And then that just gives us a starting point to explore. But it's a process and you really want to have somebody who you can trust to explore that with, ideally, like a mentor or a partner or a good friend or a therapist. To just really kind of explore that stuff and try different things. You know, if you're like, well, I don't know, I don't have time to do anything fun. Well, you're going to have to make some time and just try some stuff. Or think about what did I used to enjoy before life got busy and stressful, right? Can I reconnect with some of those things? Because that might start to show me, you know, what are some of those values and things that I really, that really matter to me. But yeah, it's very broad question and it's going to evolve over time. It's not going to stay the same for the rest of your life.
And I think that's probably something I need to accept.
Yeah.
And it actually reminded me, I don't know if it, I think he's Canadian, Dr. Jordan Peterson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, not it's not Dr. Jordan Peterson, it's Dr. John DeMartini.
Oh, okay.
If you haven't ever heard, I remember something I did. It's one of my many self-development, things that I've done throughout the years to get me to where I am today. And you, with the values thing, it actually reminded me, because he was big on values, reminded me of something that he said one time. And it was like, even if you're listening to a song and you get emotional about the song, think about what it is in that song that's made you emotional.
Exactly.
And I'd actually forgotten all about that until you were just started talking about
anything that creates like a reaction in you, good, bad or otherwise. Right, that's worth looking at because there's something in there that says something about you and what matters to you. And we often dismiss that stuff like, oh, who cares? It doesn't matter. It does, right?
How do you recommend
And this is very, once again, very broad. How do you recommend someone takes action towards what they potentially find? If it's something like, oh yeah, I can't remember what, like exactly some examples, but because some of you are like, oh yeah, but how do I take action towards that?
Yeah.
What do I do?
So let's say, I was, you know, seeing somebody and we determined that, you know, animals is an area that they're really interested and passionate about, right? So I might say, all right, well, so then how do you put that value? So we've got values there around compassion, justice, empathy, right? How do you embody those in your life? How do you act those out? Where can you demonstrate and practice compassion? So it might be with animals, but it might also be with people. A lot of people say to me, well, I like animals, I don't like people. Okay, well, we can work on that, but just pick one person maybe to have compassion for. But okay, well, where can you practice compassion, whether it be for animals or people? Where can you practice empathy? And by the way, if we're going to practice compassion for others, we need to also try and practice compassion for self. Much harder, but it takes practice. And justice. So how are we involved in justice, right? Do we want to, I mean, we could do the things like, you know, we could volunteer in an animal shelter and things like that, but we don't necessarily need to. We could get involved in different Facebook groups talking about animal rights. We could do a mini online course about, you know, animal rights or animal justice issues. We could, you know, find a book or a podcast that really, you know, indulges that interest. So it's just recognizing, oh yeah, this is something that is important to me, and then feeding it, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't have to be money dependent. It doesn't have to be big, giant, grand gestures. It can be just small things that we put our energy into each day that nurture that value and grow that value.
Researching and reading different things you say, you've said online, that I'm like, oh, pick that. Yeah, I'd love to know more about that. Another thing was that with regard to DBT, he said the skill that is most vital and essential for change, if you had to pick one, would be the distress tolerance curve.
Yeah.
Why is that, and how does the distress tolerance curve work in helping someone?
Yeah. So the distress tolerance curve is a DBT concept, and basically it shows us a few things. It illustrates how distress always passes with time, right? Which challenges this fear that we all hold, particularly when we're in the distress. Our brain starts to go, this distress is going to go on to eternity. It's going to go on forever. Now, that's a false belief, right? Mm. All emotions pass. But, you know, we need to challenge that belief. And the distress curve reminds us it's a curve, right? Given enough time, distress will always change and come down. And then it'll go up again. It'll come down. But it never stays exactly the same. It doesn't go on to infinity, right? So it tells us distress always passes. Also, when we look at the distress curve, we start to identify where on this curve do we start to engage in avoidance behaviors, okay? So if you imagine a curve, often when we start to get up the top of the curve, when distress starts to get quite high, we start to think, oh my God, I've got to get rid of this feeling, and we find ways to jump off the curve. Those are avoidance behaviors. So really common ones are like drug and alcohol use, right? Very effective avoidance behaviors, right? Self-harm for some people does that. Isolating, running away from things, literal avoidance will do that. For some people, angry outbursts will do that. Avoidance behaviors allow us to feel better momentarily. But what ends up happening is that the next time we feel distressed, we're more likely to keep jumping off the curve, not riding it out. And when we jump off the curve, we lower our tolerance to distress long term. In order to build distress tolerance, we actually need to learn how to ride out waves of distress without jumping off. Yeah. And those types of behaviors, again, no judgment, because all humans do them, right? But those types of behaviors typically will get less and less effective with time. So let's take alcohol, for example, right? A very popular distress tolerance avoidance method. So let's say somebody, you know, they have a hard day at work, they come home, they down a couple of glasses of wine. Okay, problem solved. But then next week, it's three glasses of wine. The week after that, it's a bottle of wine, right? And then they're noticing that they're drinking more, but their distress is not going down, right? It's actually going up. It increases
the next day.
Because now you've got a hangover and you've got the original distress, yes. Right? So now you've got two problems rather than one. But we can get caught in that cycle and things are actually getting worse long term. So, and I'm just using wine as an example, yeah. Right? But you know, instead what we want to do is recognize, okay, that's an avoidance strategy. How can I ride out this distress in ways that are going to make me more resilient, not less resilient, right? That are not going to add more stress to my plate than I already have. And the way we do that is by using other skills and strategies. So it might be self-soothing strategies. It might be sometimes some skillful distraction if we use that, you know, sparingly. It can be, you know, effective ways that we're relaxing or talking to ourselves or engaging in other activities, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
That help us build resilience rather than reduce it. So that's what the distress curve shows us. And when we teach the distress curve, we do it visually and we actually write in all the different skills that we then teach. So here's when we're going to use our dive skill, for example, right?
I was going to ask, is that part of that, yeah, where you'd stick your head, yeah, potentially be sticking your head in water.
So the top of that curve, right, when I'm like, we rate distress out of 5 in DBT, yeah. So 5 out of 5 is like meltdown mode.
Mm.
When I'm hitting a 4 and a 5, I'm going to use my dive skill, right?
Yeah.
And then when I'm coming back down the end of that curve, then I'm going to use some other skills, you know, that I can use. But at the top of that curve, I'm just going to use my dive skill. That's going to be better than drinking a bottle of vodka.
Yeah.
Less problematic.
Far less problematic.
Yeah.
Get over it in seconds rather than 48 hours.
Yeah.
I found this interesting and I had to go back a bit actually. You'd posted on Instagram a quote by a gentleman named William Gibson.
Yeah.
That before you diagnose yourself with depression or low self-esteem, first make sure you are not, in fact, surrounded by assholes. I found it quite amusing.
Me too.
But very, very true in such that I think our environment has a massive, they always say, you know, the 5 people you hang around, all that sort of stuff. So can you talk about the impact of our surrounding environment and maybe some advice for someone that obviously that you work with, but then they go back to their same environment and how they work with that and being able to go, oh yeah, like I feel great for an hour being with you, but then I have to step back into an environment that's problematic, let's just say.
Yeah, it's really hard. And so, yeah, I like that quote to whoever said it because it's quite funny. But it reminds me that, we can get stuck, again, pathologizing an individual and saying, oh, well, you have depression, so your brain is the problem. Rather than looking to, actually, there's a number of different factors and there might be something going on in your brain or there might not. You might be having a very understandable reaction to a bunch of crap that's going on around you, you know. So, and this happens all the time, you know, people will come in to see me and they'll say, well, I'm anxious and I'm depressed. And then we have a look at their life and, you know, relationships are a mess. Maybe there's, you know, abusive relationships going on. School or work is a nightmare. You know, it's chaos. There's so much stress. Like, so, we want to get away from seeing, you know, the person as the problem and start to understand, you know, the whole environment because we interact with our environment and vice versa.
Mm.
So we want to think about what we can control and what we can't, right? So there are things in our external environment that we may not be able to change right away. And so we've got to accept that. However, there is always some shift that we can make in how we approach things. So for example, if I'm working with somebody and maybe there's a relationship that's really toxic that they're involved in, we might talk about strategies that they can use even if they stay in that relationship, to minimize the damage. So could we work on some boundaries? right? Yeah. Could we work on maybe, you know, a bit more balance where we're incorporating other healthier relationships as well, right? So it's not just that relationship. Can we factor in some other pleasurable activities that's giving them a sense of, you know, pride and accomplishment and mastery and identity to help balance out that toxic relationship? Mm. You know, there's a bunch of things we could do, even if they choose to stay in it for now. Or if they're in a situation where, say, they're at a job or at school where, you know, they actually have to be there for now and they can't get out of it. Okay, so what can we work on that is within your control? So we often say there's four options for dealing with any problem.
Yeah.
Number one, we could solve the problem. Now, if you can do that, if you can just fix it, then fix it, right? That's not always the case.
Probably a very small percentage.
Very small percentage. Number two option is to change our emotional response to the problem. So that could be, what am I believing about the problem? How am I responding? How am I engaging with it? Sometimes when we're, you know, interacting with, you know, chaotic or not so helpful other environments, we might be telling ourselves that it's our fault or that we're doing something wrong or we're lacking in worth or something that we could work on there, right? We could challenge that. And a third option could be to radically accept the problem. Now, radical acceptance is a skill that we teach. It means trying to accept things that are unacceptable. So we're not saying we're happy with it, but we're just saying for the moment, this is not something I can change. It might be, for example, with a lot of our young people, the fact that they have to go to school, right? You have to legally attend school, even if you hate it. I know why you hate it. I know the school system maybe should be, you know, more adaptable and more flexible, but it is the way that it is. We're not going to change that today. Could we radically accept it? What that does is then it frees up the person to think about, all right, well, then where do I want to put my energy? If I don't want to put my energy into fighting this every day, because that's really stressful, if I could radically accept it, I could maybe put my energy elsewhere, right? So it's a bit of a strategy that we can use. And the fourth option is to stay miserable. It's always an option. Just keep going, keep doing that and stay miserable, but that's not a great option. But we could do that if we choose to. We'll just be aware that we're doing that. That sometimes happens if we're like, well, I know I could do some things to make this better, but I just don't want to. Cool. Yeah. Don't, but just know that's what you're choosing. No judgment.
Yeah.
But sometimes we choose that. We call that willfulness of like, well, I know I could do some things to change this, but I just don't want to. All right. Just keep doing that until you do want to then.
Yeah.
But that's always an option. So we want to look holistically at our whole, like everywhere we're interacting, change what we can, and then use some of those other skills for the other stuff, you know? But it's not as simple as, okay, like the problem is my brain. And if I just fix that, everything will be better. It's not that simple. Yeah. The brain problem's pretty minimal most of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all the other things. It's, you know, relationships and stress and obligations and work-life juggle and all of that stuff that we all deal with that can cause a lot of problems.
And school, you touched on school and teens and school, and you obviously you've not only got educational experience now, but you've got personal experience shipped off to the US, the Rocky Mountain Academy.
Yeah.
You've got your own beliefs about the current school system. And so a kid comes to you and says, like, and you can see that they're going through almost what you've gone through and experienced in your early life.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that's a whole topic within itself, but I'm curious of how you deal with it and how you help kids through.
Yeah.
Albeit, and I feel the same way completely, like where there's the schooling system hasn't changed for a very long time, and I don't know enough about it to have a full on comment about it or anything. So, and I don't know what can be done about it either.
Yeah.
But how do you help kids through that? Like, how do you help kids find that, as you say, you've legally got to go to school for some period of time, and so you've got to have that acceptance that this is a crappy position. I don't enjoy being here. I know for myself, I didn't like I
did all right at school in year 11 and 12. I just fell off the cliff and didn't do very well at school because I didn't see the point, basically. Yeah. And at the time, yeah, I felt that way. I needed to be here to year 12. The subjects back in the early 90s that you had to take at school, I often feel like I couldn't understand. I was like, I don't need that. Admittedly, funnily enough, one of those was computer studies, and I've now ended up in an IT role. Yeah. So I find that's quite ironic. And I remember in the early 90s going, computer studies? What do I need that for? Who needs that? That's never going to work, you know. But you can't see that when you're 16 and whatever at school.
No.
So how do you align that with kids?
Yeah. So a couple of things. First, you know, whenever I meet a young person who's struggling with school, I just want to validate that school's really hard for a lot of kids, and it is not designed to be a flexible, nurturing, individual, you know, environment. And that's through no fault. Like, teachers are amazing. The work they do is amazing. Oh,
100%.
But it's the system, right, that we have that's just, it just doesn't meet a lot of kids' needs and is really hard for a lot of kids. So, and yeah, when kids say to me, oh, well, I'm learning this stuff and it's pointless, I'm like, well, it probably is, right? But you getting that HSC completed, it's going to give you options. Right? Like, it doesn't matter what mark you get. It doesn't matter, you know, any of that, but you're going to have more freedom and options if you have that piece of paper than if you don't, right? Unless there's a trade or something else that you want to do that has a purpose. But if you don't know, there are advantages to that. It makes life easier later on, right? And we can see that. Like, I can see that as an adult, seeing people that obviously, you know, didn't finish school versus finishing school. It's much harder if you don't finish school.
Mm.
It just is. So, you know, I validate that, yes, what they're learning is pointless, it is boring, and it's not a nice place to be, right? So I'm not going to try and convince them otherwise, because that's the truth for them. But then we're going to talk about how avoiding hard things is not the way to long-term resilience, right? And so, because often then, you know, what young people will do is that they'll stop going to school, right? Because that's just the solution. But what's happening is that is then making things worse, right? Parents are pissed off, school's pissed off. You know, they go back for a day and they've missed so much. So now it's much harder. Everything gets harder. So we start to have a look at what are the consequences of avoiding this thing that I know you hate it, and I know that it's hard, and I know that, you know, it seems pointless. However, avoiding it is actually making things worse for you. So how could we increase your capacity to tolerate this horrible place called school, right? So again, the goal is not to somehow get you out of school. The goal is to increase your resilience to this place called school. And we do that by building skills. We also need to factor in what are the other things in your life that you are enjoying that you're getting a sense of pride and mastery in, right? And they'll often say, well, I don't have time. Well, let's make time, right? Let's find it and make it. Sometimes I will, and my team will do the same. Sometimes we'll work with schools around managing certain behaviors. So some of the young people that we see, especially if they're like self-harming behaviors or things like that, or a lot of school avoidance, we might actually work with the school so that the school can reinforce some of the skills that we're teaching to help the young person be there and to build up their tolerance to being there. So that might be doing, you know, reduced hours for a little while, building up, having options for support outside of class, having access to skillful distraction and other methods while they're in school as a way of building them back up to going back. Because sometimes by the time they come to see us, they haven't been to school for 3-4 months and we're like, okay, we've got a lot of avoidance going on. So we have to build that back up. We might work with the school, and schools are usually very open to that. They want skills too. They're like, help us out, right? Because they're trying to teach these kids and discipline them and write reports and tick all the boxes and manage these behaviors. It's really hard. So we'll often write a bit of a plan and everybody's on the same page. Same with parents. We might get them to tweak how they're addressing it.
Yeah.
We might say, look, yep, let's have a plan to gradually build up to school, but let's try and reduce the yelling and the screaming around it. Let's try and understand that the distress is real, but we're also not going to provide secondary gains for staying home, right? we're not going to allow, just stay home and go online and do whatever you want, right? Like, that's not reality.
Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do that either. Yeah. So we're going to find a middle ground, because that happens too. You know, parents will say, well, you know, they won't go to school. And I'm like, well, what are they doing at home all day? Well, they're just gaming all day. Yeah. And I'm like, why is your internet on, right? Yeah, yeah. Well, like, come on. Like, if I, as a teenager, had a choice to stay home and game all day, if that was my thing,
yeah,
or go to school, I'm staying home. It's not even a choice. It's silly, right? So we don't want to get punitive, but we also, you know, we want to make the choice an easier one. But the young person first really needs to understand why avoidance isn't going to work long term. That's the first hurdle. Once the young person understands that, they become really willing to build up their resilience, even though it's still not going to be fun. And then life starts to get better because everybody else calms down. School gets easier. And hopefully we can also start to build in some of those, you know, pleasurable things into their life to give them that little bit of balance while they have to go to school, you know?
And I mean, school, I'm sure you deal with kids. I don't know what the ages are, but I'm going to guess they range from sort of, you know, year four up sort of thing, or potentially, or whatever that is. You mentioned about avoidance, like really realizing that avoidance isn't, and like we talked about before with avoiding emotions, isn't right. How do you teach a child like that? What technique, or even to make them realize that avoidance, like you mentioned avoidance techniques before, like putting a little bit of pain, a little bit for a teenager, for a kid like that? Yeah. Like what?
So we work with 13 years and older. So just because, the younger kids, it's a bit of a different ball game. But 13 and up.
Yeah.
So we will often visually draw out a lot of things. So that distress tolerance curve that I was telling you about, we visually draw that out with them in a session. We'll get them to identify how they're jumping off the curve, and they'll say, well, I just don't go to school. Cool. Let's draw that in there. Mm-hmm. Right. So we start to get them to see visually, you know, these concepts. And then we also use a lot of good old-fashioned pros and cons skills. We do them a little bit differently in DBT, but we get to we start to explore, okay, what are you getting by continuing to do this? Because there is a benefit there, but what are you giving up?
Yeah.
Right? And when we start to talk about it like that in a totally non-judgmental way, like, I'm not here to say you're a bad person for not going to school. Not at all. I totally get why you don't want to go to school.
Yeah.
But it seems like life is getting harder, not easier. So let's change that, right? Because I don't want them to suffer more, and they don't want to suffer more. So we start to look at, okay, so these behaviors, what you're getting is that, okay, you don't have the stress of having to go to school, but what you're giving up is like that enjoyment in life that you want. You're not getting to see your friends. You're not feeling good about yourself. Everyone in your family is yelling at you. You're getting calls from the Department of Education, right? There's a lot of stress.
Yeah.
So you're getting this short-term gain, but you're giving up all of this stuff. When they start to see that, they can then decide, oh, okay, well, that actually isn't a great trade-off anymore. But for young people especially, and adults do this too, when we're stuck in avoidance behaviors, we're often just fixated on like, this is working for me. And we're not seeing, I mean, if you come into my office, it's not working clearly, right? Like, something's not working. Yeah. People don't come in here because things are going well. So we start to thought, it is working in some ways, but it's also not working in other ways. Yeah. And let's just get really aware of that. So yeah, we use a lot of visuals. We use a lot of like pros and cons and exploring what you're getting and giving up. And then we just get real practical with skills. I'm not saying just go to school and tough it out.
Yeah,
I'm saying, right, let's go to school. Let's write down some skills that you can use at school. Let's give the school a copy. Let's give your parents a copy. Let's practice them together. Let's try them, see what works, what doesn't work, tweak them as we go. Lots of validation when they try stuff. And gradually they start to feel more confident doing that. So we've got to have practical skills as well. Again, like that dive skill we were talking about, that'd be one of the ones I'd be teaching them. Paced breathing, other things they can do at school when they need to.
Yeah.
And then working with the school to say, how can this child get a timeout if needed? Where can they get support if needed? Can they have fidget toys? Can they have an iPod? Can they have, that's old school now, isn't it? What can they have to help them get through as they build up this tolerance? And so when you get practical, young people tend to get more motivated to do it.
Yeah.
Because you're not just saying, tough it out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. I didn't think you'd say that. That's why I was curious to know that approach.
Yeah. And look, at the basis. And especially
considering you've been through, like, you got shipped off.
Yeah.
So, like, you know.
Well outsourced. The key thing, too, that I'll mention is the most important thing in helping somebody in this role is relationship. Right. So if I can't form a trusting relationship with somebody, then nothing good's going to happen. So that has to come first. So a lot of the initial work that my team and I do, particularly with young people, because they tend to be a bit more wary of professionals, and rightly so, is we work on relationship. So we try and not be like a professional up here and the patient down here. We try and make that a little bit more equal, even though it's not totally equal, but we try and minimize it. We just try and be real people and develop real relationships, right? So they feel like they're genuinely cared about, they're genuinely heard and understood. And if they feel understood, then any suggestions I make are going to be, they're going to be much more open to that.
Mm.
I don't go in just, you know, initially saying, right, do this. I've got to form a relationship first.
Some of that must come from sharing your own story a little bit in some way, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't typically share it, but sometimes people will ask and then I'll share it if I'm asked. It's funny because in training, like social work training, psychology training, counseling training, a lot of the training is like, do not self-disclose.
Yeah.
Be like a neutral slate, a blank slate. And it's bad advice because all the research tells us relationship is what gets people better.
Mm.
So for me going to America, what got me better was those relationships.
Mm.
And then I was able to learn things because we had the relationship. Yeah. I was open to it. But same in therapy. All the research says the thing that determines good outcomes is good therapeutic relationship. So I can't just be a neutral being in a chair. I have to be a real person. And that means sometimes I might self-disclose or share a personal experience if it's appropriate.
Yeah.
Certainly if a client asks, I will. But it's just about, like, you got to be a real person and you've got to genuinely care. You can't be pretending to care. And so that's the most important thing. And then once you've got that, you can build all the other things into it.
Yeah.
But I've found, too, with, like, hiring team, some people it just comes naturally to them. They can just engage with people. People feel safe and warm in their presence.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to teach. Some people have it. And people that have it tend to be pretty good clinicians.
Yeah. I can imagine. And so that brings me on to, and I think you mentioned it a little bit before, like you've gone and flipped it and now training and providing educational services for other Central Coast, and potentially it's out from what I can see with Central Coast, but potentially it's even outside of Central Coast because I think a lot of your stuff's online.
Yeah.
How did you end up in the educational space for DBT?
Yeah. So what I found, you know, moving into this space with my private practice, a lot of other health professionals and even mental health professionals don't have confidence in treating borderline personality disorder, treating complex mental health issues, treating self-harm. It's not something that they've been trained in, so they're very unsure about it. And so, again, because there's that gap in services where chronically complex clients don't have a lot on offer, I want to train more health professionals and mental health professionals to know how to work with these people because they deserve a service and they need a service. Again, the suicide rates are really high amongst this group of people diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and even, you know, self-harm and suicidal behaviors obviously have huge risks attached. So there's a real need there. We need to get the suicide rate down. It's still unacceptably high.
I had a conversation with someone recently that was saying it's actually increased.
Yeah.
Has it? It's like.
So it went down during COVID.
Yeah.
And then it's increased again to higher levels. So consistently, if we take COVID out of it, that was an anomaly. Every year it goes up. Mm. So it's getting worse every year. And so, you know, this is something I'm really passionate about. The mental health services we have are not working, clearly. Mm. And, you know, there's a range of reasons people might end their lives, but there's an unacceptable number of people ending their lives. Mm. And this gap in services where, you know, if you're suicidal, if you say that to somebody, you get sent to hospital and then you're there for 24 hours and then they send you home and they might call you. Like that's not enough, right? We need to, there's different reasons for people being suicidal. We need to have different therapeutic approaches for those people. So training other professionals in working with suicidal individuals and complex individuals, my hope is there'll be more professionals who can support these people in a way that's effective and non-judgmental. There's still a lot of stigma within mental health services about borderline personality disorder. It's a really highly stigmatized disorder. And there are services who actively refuse to work with people with that diagnosis, which I think needs to change. So I'm just trying to get that education out there because I think that stigma arises just from a lack of understanding and a feeling like, well, I can't help these people, so I don't want to work with them. If you have the right tools to work with these people, it's pretty easy, actually. So get the right tools, yeah? And then maybe we can start to do something about that suicide rate. But, yeah, we've got a long way to go. So, yeah, the education I do with professionals, I really love it because there are professionals out there that really want to learn.
Yeah.
And again, with the right knowledge and the right skills, they realize they can help complex clients rather than just referring them on. They can actually help them and get great outcomes. So that's what we want.
It's a bit left field, but only because it came up in the last interview I did where Luke had done some mental health training with Yeren, I think.
Yeah.
And he'd mentioned in one of his posts, so I asked a question about it, was that he'd actually ran into someone at Shelley Beach, Indigenous man, and he went up to him and said, mate, and they started talking. Yeah. He was like, are you looking at going to kill yourself?
Yeah.
And he was like, yep. Mm-hmm. And we spoke about like what he did in that scenario and basically he just stayed with the person and yeah, that sort of stuff. I'm curious until help, and his advice was, he's like, if you ever come across it, you just need to stay with them. Don't try to give advice. You just need to sit with them until other help can arrive.
Yeah.
I'm curious from obviously your line of work, what your advice would be to someone in that scenario.
That is good advice. So there's two common reactions that are unhelpful that we want to stay away from. One reaction is ignoring, like, oh, well, you'll be right. Okay. Because if somebody is talking about suicide, we know that there's a very high likelihood they might act on those thoughts.
Mm.
So we don't want to ignore. But the other reaction that's unhelpful is kind of a freak out reaction of like, oh my God, this is I'm out of my depth. You know, call the ambulance immediately and you know, that kind of reaction. We want something in between where we're hearing what the person is saying, but we're willing to stay and kind of just be there. Suicidal behaviors are the symptom. The problem is very high distress and a belief that things won't get better. Yeah. Right. So once we understand that's the problem, how do we address the distress? Well, I stay here with this person. I talk to them like a normal person. I show them that I care. I show them that they're not alone. Right. That's helping with that distress. But then, yes, like if somebody is at that stage where they're actively wanting to take their lives, then we do need to get crisis services involved. But again, we can do that in a really humane and caring way, where we stay with them throughout, we check in on them, we provide them support afterwards or whatever, right? Mm. Whatever that looks like. Crisis services don't have a magic answer to suicidality. It's complicated and it takes a lot of different things, but sometimes people need that crisis service to intervene just to keep them alive until other things can be put into place. But ultimately what they're going to need is long-term support, right? And connection. And to be able to talk about their suicidal thoughts and their feelings without judgment. I know it's a scary topic and it makes people really uncomfortable when people talk about suicide. But we want to be able to talk about it and understand that, okay, if someone's talking about this, they're in a lot of distress. Tell me about that. Mm. Tell me what's going on for you that's causing you distress. And I can't solve it for you, but I'm going to validate. That's really hard. Tell me more, you know? So it's that human connection. So yeah, I think that's good advice, you know, that first of all, don't be afraid to ask the question, right? Are you thinking of taking your life? It's not going to put the idea in their mind. Just ask it. And if they say yes, then stay with them and figure out what they need. If it's imminent, then we need to get crisis services involved. But then what, right? What are the supports? Who needs to be involved? What does this need to look like? And hang in there. You know, don't think that they go to hospital and they're going to get fixed and then they're out and then everything's fine. It's not like that. They're going to need support. Yeah. So, yeah, again, it's reducing that stigma around talking about suicide.
And that was a big conversation I had with him, was just removing the stigma in general of mental health. Yeah. And trying to do that more and more. And what he was trying to do is do that. And like, and how do we do that? And that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So that there isn't that stigma, so that those people, because potentially, and I don't know, you'd know, but if I think about it, potentially some of those things, people get to that point because there is such a stigma around potentially going and seeking help, so they refuse to seek help, so therefore you end up in a worse situation than what you would have done if you had to just seek help in the first place.
Yeah. The really dangerous point people can get to is when they've been in a lot of distress and pain for quite a long time and they're believing it's not going to get better. And they start believing that it's just them, like there's just something wrong with them and no one can help them because it's just them, right? That's a very dangerous place for someone to be, because they're not going to reach out for help because they think no one can help them anyways. And they start to think they are the problem. And if they just take themselves out of the equation, then everything will be fixed. And people also get to the point, they genuinely start to think people that love them they'll be upset for a while, but they'll get over it. And they don't, right? Like if you've ever met anybody who's been affected by suicide, people do not get over that. It changes their lives. And so there's this perception of the suicidal person that can get really dangerous. And so, yeah, we want people to feel like they can talk about suicide without people freaking out or ignoring them. Again, that middle ground approach. Yeah. And we want them to know that there is actually effective treatment. It's not a matter of just into hospital and then back home with a phone call. There are other things that can help. They do take effort. They might involve money, right? Unfortunately, that's just the reality. But it's worth it if you can create a life that feels worth living, right? So, yeah, we really want to challenge that idea that suicide for some people is inevitable. It's not. There are other options. Suicide is based on a false belief things will never get better. And unfortunately, that's a powerful belief, but it's just not true.
Yeah.
But we may have to change some things to make things get better.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's tricky too because, as you know, the media has rules around speaking about suicide.
They're not allowed to anymore at all.
Not allowed to. Which I understand the rationale because there's this contagion effect potentially. But I think the risks of a contagion effect versus the risks of not talking about it, we have to weigh that up. Surely the risks of not talking about it are greater than...
Because they were worried about copycat stuff if they were promoted.
There's some old research.
Shared.
There's some old research that suggests that if you talk about suicides in detail, like the means, then there will be this contagion effect where other people start to act on that. That research is pretty old. I think probably it needs to be looked at again. But again, you know, okay, if we accept there is some risk of contagion, and I would argue that nobody becomes suicidal because they've heard about it. They're already struggling, right? Okay, so how do we identify people who are struggling better and how do we get them help more easily, right? Where are the services that are allowed to say, if you're suicidal, come and talk to us? There's very few of us around. You know, we say that, but we even have to be careful how we show up online and in our marketing because you use the suicide word and you get shut down all over the place. Yet, you know, our service is somewhere where suicidal people can come and talk about suicide really safely, right? We're not going to be calling ambulances and freaking out. We deal with it day in and day out. But how do we get that message out there? is really hard. So yeah, I think we need to rethink looking at that research about the contagion effect and do a cost benefit analysis.
Yeah.
I think whatever we're doing isn't working. It's getting worse. So we've got to change it.
Yeah, well, as you say, the figures point to that.
Yeah, yeah. They're just going higher and higher. And it's not all because of social media, despite what people say.
Yeah.
It's not the cause.
What is your thoughts on social media?
I think social media is a really beneficial tool at connecting people, but it can also be, it can be really harmful. You know, it can be both. I think that we want to teach young people in particular how to be selective around what they expose themselves to,
yeah.
Have boundaries around what content you're seeing and what you engage with, and understand that has an impact on you. And just like we would say, be careful who your friends are, right? Yeah. Be careful what you're looking at online. It's going to have an impact on you. But social media itself is not the devil. It's a great way lots of people connect and share stories and identify with one another, but people are involved. So, you know, there's always the dark side.
Yeah.
But that's not why suicide rates are higher. You know, I think that's a complex issue. But, you know, lack of appropriate mental health services has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, wow. Lastly, if a parent is concerned about their own child's mental health, though is unsure how to approach them about it, what advice would you give? And noted that this is no doubt potentially, like you said, from 13
up.
But it may be the same sort of advice, but if it isn't, like in that teenage years and then maybe an older child.
Yeah, yeah. So the first advice I always give is choose your timing wisely, right? Don't try and talk to your teenager about it when they're just stressed out, just home from school, in the middle of an online game, in a text battle with their friends. Like, don't even bother, right? Choose your timing. You know, try and create activities where, you know, you can catch up. So it might be like when you get them in the car. I know for a lot of parents, that's like you have a kind of a captive audience.
Mm.
That might be when you choose to talk. Or a routine of like taking the dog for a walk with you, or take them out to lunch and a shopping trip and talk to them then, right? So timing's really important. When things are calm and everybody's calm, that's when you're going to have, you know, your greatest chance. Otherwise, you'll just get a door slammed in your face.
Yeah.
So choose your timing and ask questions and listen and just shut up, right? So talk less, listen more. So you could say to your young person, for example, like, hey, so I've like noticed you don't seem like yourself recently, or like you seem upset or stressed out. Like, what's going on? Right. And then just shut up and listen. Yeah. And if they're like, oh, yeah, I don't want to talk about it, da da da. Okay. Well, cool. That's fine. Respect that. All right. If you do want to talk about it, I'm here, you know, like I don't have any answers, but I'm happy to listen. Right? That will often get them talking. What young people don't want is advice, right? You have to listen first and then they'll be open to some advice if it's delivered in the right way. But you have to listen first.
Mm.
So tell them you're not going to give them advice. Tell them you're just there to listen. Tell them that you've noticed that, you know, they're having a hard time, but you're just there to listen if they want to talk about it. Plant the seed, leave it alone, revisit it. But eventually when they start talking, then you got to stick to that. So don't jump into, well, what you should do is A, B, C, D, E. Listen, validate, ask them what they think might help. And if they're like, I don't know, I don't want to do, then you can start to plant seeds and say, well, you know, do you want me to see if there's like, do you want to maybe talk to a counselor? I could ask around and see who might be good. Do you want me to research that for you? Yeah, okay, fine. Do you want me to book the appointment? I'll pay for it. Sure. Right? So you can do all these things to help it without saying you should do this. As soon as you tell a young person what they should do, they're not going to do it.
Mm.
So it's a gentle, gentle approach. And yeah, listen more, talk less. That makes sense. And if you're concerned about suicidal stuff, ask. Flat out just ask. And if they say they are having suicidal thoughts, the mental health access line's a good place to start. I'll give you that number if you like.
Yeah.
They, so they're the community team. If there's concern of imminent risk, then they can get all the right services involved right away. But if not, they can also kind of direct you to where to go. They might say, look, you might want to, you know, talk to your GP or go see these people or jump online and see who's around, get some recommendations, depending on how urgent or how serious the suicidal thoughts are. But if you're not sure, just ask. Again, it's not going to put the idea in their mind.
Yeah.
Just ask.
I think that's what people would be afraid of. Yeah. By asking it, that's impregnating an idea into someone's mind by asking it.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to hear you say it's not going to put the idea.
That's not how that works.
It's not how that works.
Young people are aware that suicide is a thing, right? It's not like we're introducing them to the idea.
Yeah.
But if they're thinking about it, so the research says that most people, like 90-odd percent of people who are having suicidal thoughts will tell someone before they act on them. So if we ask the question, we're creating an environment where, you know, we're saying, I want to know if you're having these thoughts and we can intervene early so that it doesn't get worse and worse and worse. And then if, again, if we have that response of, I'm not going to freak out and I'm not going to ignore it, we're going to do something in the middle, then that tells the young person, oh, okay, so this is something I can talk about. Right. And we want them to talk about it so that we can do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not going to give them the idea. They are very aware that this is something that happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if we provide an environment where they can talk about it, they will.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we want to keep them safe and do what we need to do.
Yeah. Well, Alex, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you. I've kept you for a long time. Pleasure. Sorry.
That's okay.
I told you I would ramble on if you let me go.
Yeah, and I'll let you go because it's a topic I'm very interested in, to be honest, like just mental health in general. I'm on my own mental health journey, so it's very much a topic that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
And lucky me, I get to sit here and ask questions that I'm like, oh.
That's cool.
Hang on. I want to know more about that. Yeah. And so not only am I on that journey, but I'm also a parent now, or not now, for the last 8 years. So I'm very interested in that. And, in the back of my head is, oh, how am I going to tackle that at some point potentially? Or, you know, so for me, I feel very privileged to be able to sit here and pick someone's brain like yourself at the end of the day, to be honest.
Thank you. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
So, yeah. So thank you, Alex.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks.
Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the Central Coast of New South Wales.